Have you ever wondered what would happen if Shakespeare's Macbeth was reimagined for our tech-obsessed, environmentally precarious era? Eleanor Catton's Burnham Wood delivers exactly that, a contemporary eco-thriller that has captivated readers worldwide since its 2023 release. This Booker Prize-winning author's third novel has been praised by Barack Obama, who included it in his summer reading list, and acclaimed by critics as a masterful blend of psychological suspense and political commentary. The novel's exploration of idealism versus pragmatism in environmental activism feels particularly relevant in our climate crisis era, while its examination of surveillance capitalism has drawn comparisons to the works of Dave Eggers and Jonathan Franzen. What begins as a story about guerrilla gardeners quickly transforms into a high-stakes moral thriller that forces us to question, how far would we go to protect our principles or to protect ourselves? Mira Bunting, founder of the guerrilla gardening collective Burnham Wood, is trespassing on an abandoned farm when she encounters Robert Lemoyne, a charismatic American billionaire. Their chance meeting sets in motion a chain of events that will challenge everything Mira believes about herself and her mission. Burnham Wood operates on the fringes of legality, planting crops on unused land without permission. For years, they've struggled to sustain their environmental activism while barely making ends meet. When Mira discovers the Darvish property, a sprawling farm left vacant after a landslide closed the nearby mountain pass, she sees it as the perfect opportunity to expand their operation. What she doesn't expect is to encounter Lemoyne, who catches her photographing the property. Rather than reporting her trespassing, he surprises her by offering permission to use the land. He claims to have purchased it from the Darvishes and presents himself as a wealthy survivalist planning to build a bunker there. For Mira, this unexpected windfall seems too good to be true. A wealthy benefactor willing to fund their grassroots environmental movement while they cultivate his land. The moral compromise is immediate and seductive. Mira, who has built her identity around anti-capitalist principles, finds herself drawn not only to Lemoyne's resources, but to the man himself. Their connection represents the novel's central tension, the collision between idealistic principles and pragmatic opportunities. Can revolutionary movements maintain their integrity while accepting support from the very systems they oppose? Or does compromise inevitably lead to corruption? This tension is embodied in Mira's internal struggle. She justifies the partnership by focusing on what Burnham Wood could accomplish with proper funding, expanding their impact, reaching more communities, and creating sustainable food systems. Yet beneath her rationalizations lurks the uncomfortable truth that she's compromising the collective's founding principles for expediency and, perhaps, for her own ambition. Robert Lemoyne embodies the insidious nature of surveillance capitalism. Charming, seemingly transparent, yet constantly monitoring and manipulating those around him. Within 20 minutes of spotting Mira on the property, he executes a man-in-the-middle attack on her phone, gaining complete access to her data, communications, and even the ability to alter her messages. Lemoyne represents a new kind of villain for our digital age, one who doesn't need physical force when information provides more effective control. His surveillance extends beyond the digital realm. He monitors Mira with drones as she explores the property, creating an invisible web of observation that she doesn't even perceive. This asymmetry of information becomes his greatest power. What makes Lemoyne truly terrifying is how he weaponizes intimacy. He studies Mira's data to understand her vulnerabilities, desires, and relationships, then uses this knowledge to manipulate her emotions. When he meets her, he already knows her name, her history, and her motivations. This invasion feels particularly violating because it happens without physical boundaries being crossed. The most private aspects of her life have been accessed without her knowledge or consent. The novel forces us to confront uncomfortable truths about our own digital vulnerability. How much of ourselves do we unwittingly expose through our devices? What stories could be constructed about us from our search histories, messages, and location data? LeMoyne surveillance represents an extreme version of what tech companies do every day, harvesting our data to predict and influence our behavior. His character also explores the God complex that extreme wealth and technological power can create. When flying his plane, LeMoyne experiences a profound sense of his own proportion and a holy sense of having pilgrimaged. This quasi-religious language reveals how technology and wealth have replaced traditional sources of meaning, creating a dangerous sense of entitlement and moral exemption. The most chilling aspect of LeMoyne's character is how he views other people as variables to be controlled rather than autonomous beings. He prefers situations that are single, swift, and clean rather than messy and multiple, treating human lives as complications in his algorithmic approach to reality. This dehumanization represents the logical endpoint of a worldview that reduces everything, including people, to data points. The arrival of LeMoyne's offer exposes the ideological fault lines within Burnham Wood, particularly between Mira and her former friend and occasional lover, Tony Gallo. Their confrontation during the collective's vote on accepting LeMoyne's proposal crystallizes the novel's central ethical question. Is it possible to work within a corrupt system to change it, or does engagement inevitably lead to complicity? Tony represents uncompromising ideological purity. He condemns LeMoyne's offer as blood money, arguing that drones are weapons of terror, surveillance is oppressive, and billionaires fundamentally undermine solidarity. His position is clear: we're getting into bed with the enemy. For Tony, principles must remain untainted by pragmatic compromises, even if it means limiting the collective's immediate impact. Mira counters with pragmatism, arguing that Tony doesn't understand their struggles to sustain the movement. She emphasizes that they're living their principles through daily work and sacrifice, suggesting that abstract ideological purity means little without practical action. Her position reflects a utilitarian approach. If partnering with LeMoyne allows them to help more people and create more sustainable food systems, isn't that worth the compromise? This debate reflects broader tensions within activist movements. Should they maintain ideological purity at the cost of immediate impact, or compromise for practical gains while risking co-option? The novel doesn't provide easy answers, but illustrates how these tensions can fracture communities built around shared values. The relationship between Mira and Shelley further complicates this dynamic. As Mira's closest friend and right hand in Burnham Wood, Shelley initially supports the partnership with LeMoyne, yet her support stems partly from wanting Mira's approval, creating an unhealthy power dynamic that will later unravel with devastating consequences. When Shelley realizes Mira has romantic feelings for LeMoyne, jealousy and betrayal add personal dimensions to their ideological differences. These interpersonal conflicts reveal how political movements are inevitably shaped by human emotions, jealousy, ambition, desire for approval, as much as by principles. The novel suggests that no movement, however noble its aims, can escape the messiness of human psychology. Deception runs through Burnham Wood like an underground river, shaping the landscape above while remaining largely invisible. Every character wears masks, some to deceive others, some to deceive themselves. LeMoyne's entire presence in New Zealand is built on layers of deception. He presents himself to the Darvishes as a wealthy survivalist interested in building a bunker on their property, while his true purpose involves extracting rare earth minerals worth not just billions, but trillions. Even more disturbing, he's manipulated mercenaries into believing they're working for the CIA to break China's market dominance in rare earths, when they're actually participating in an unauthorized and environmentally devastating mining operation. Mira's deceptions are more complex and often directed inward. She justifies her attraction to LeMoyne and her willingness to compromise Burnham Wood's principles through elaborate rationalizations. When confronted by Tony, she frames her decisions as necessary sacrifices for the greater good, yet her motivations include personal ambition and romantic attraction. Later, after becoming complicit in covering up Owen Darvish's death, she imagines scenarios where she's portrayed as the victim rather than the perpetrator, revealing her desperate need to maintain a positive self-image despite her actions. Shelley's deceptions initially seem more innocent, hiding her jealousy of Mira's leadership and her resentment at always playing second fiddle. Yet these suppressed emotions eventually explode with tragic consequences when she takes acid and accidentally kills Owen Darvish with the collective's van. Her subsequent attempt to normalize this horrific event by claiming she was simply leaving for a job interview reveals the extreme psychological mechanisms we employ to avoid confronting our worst actions. Even Tony, who positions himself as the moral conscience of the group, engages in deception. He lies to his friend Rosie about his whereabouts and borrows a car under false pretenses to investigate Lemoyne. While his intentions may be noble, exposing environmental crimes, his methods involve deception that endangers others. The novel suggests that deception is not merely a moral failing, but a psychological necessity. We construct narratives that allow us to live with our compromises and contradictions. Yet these self-protective fictions eventually collide with reality, often with devastating consequences. At its core, Burnham Wood explores the relationship between humanity and the natural world, examining how exploitation of nature mirrors exploitation of people. The novel's setting in New Zealand, often portrayed as an untouched paradise, provides the perfect backdrop for this exploration. Lemoyne's secret operation in Korowai National Park represents the most extreme form of environmental exploitation. He's conducting solution mining for rare earth elements, pumping lixiviant through boreholes in a process that risks causing fissures in the bedrock. When a landslide occurs as a result, he calculates that any resulting seismic activity would be attributed to the nearby Alpine Fault. His cold risk assessment that the remote location meant minimal witnesses reveals the callous logic of extractive capitalism. This exploitation of nature parallels Lemoyne's exploitation of people. Just as he views the national park as a resource to be extracted for profit, he sees people as assets to be manipulated. He recruits mercenaries under false pretenses, manipulates the Darvishes with lies about his intentions for their property, and uses Mira's idealism against her. In both cases, the underlying logic is the same. Everything and everyone is a potential resource to be utilized for personal gain. Burnham Wood represents a different relationship with nature, one based on stewardship rather than exploitation. Their guerrilla gardening aims to create sustainable food systems that work with natural processes rather than against them. Yet even their approach is not without contradictions. They trespass on private property, imposing their vision of proper land use without permission from owners or local communities. Their methods, while less destructive than industrial agriculture, still involve human intervention in natural systems. The novel asks whether any human interaction with nature can avoid becoming exploitative. Can we cultivate without colonizing? Can we harvest without harming? These questions extend beyond environmental ethics to human relationships. Can we connect with others without eventually using them for our own purposes? The Shakespearean reference in the title points to this theme. In Macbeth, the prophecy that Burnham Wood shall come to Dunsinane seems impossible. How can a forest move? Yet it comes true when soldiers camouflage themselves with tree branches. This image of humans disguised as nature reflects the novel's exploration of how we often mask our exploitative intentions behind environmental rhetoric. When Owen Darvish unexpectedly returns to his property and is accidentally killed by Shelley while she's under the influence of acid, the novel shifts from exploring theoretical moral compromises to the immediate, visceral consequences of complicity. Lemoyne quickly takes control of the situation, convincing Mira they must stage an accident to protect Shelley and Burnham Wood. With meticulous attention to detail, they move Darvish's body from the gravel driveway to his rental SUV, carefully removing evidence and fabricating a story about him driving off a cliff at Korowai Pass Lookout. Lemoyne even manipulates Darvish's phone, erasing location data and creating fake email evidence. this cover-up represents a point of no return for Mira, a moment when abstract moral compromises become concrete criminal actions. Her complicity in this deception transforms her relationship with herself and others. She can no longer maintain the fiction that she's merely bending principles for a greater good. She has become an active participant in a criminal conspiracy. The psychological toll of this complicity is immediate and devastating. Mira experiences paralyzing shock, sitting motionless for hours after returning to the safe house with Shelley. She attempts to distract herself with a jigsaw puzzle of golden retriever puppies, an image of innocence that contrasts sharply with her actions. Later, she imagines her future in prison and feels disgusted at her attempts to find someone more monstrous than herself to ease her guilt. Shelley's response to complicity takes a different form. Still processing the trauma of killing someone, she experiences time as fractured and looping, repeatedly reliving the horrific moment of impact. Her mind creates psychological defenses, counting obsessively, pretending the accident hasn't happened yet if she remains perfectly still. When forced to confront reality, she attempts to normalize the situation by claiming she was leaving for a job interview, revealing the extreme lengths we go to avoid acknowledging our worst actions. The novel suggests that complicity changes us in fundamental ways, eroding our sense of self and our connections to others. Once Mira and Shelley become complicit in covering up Darvish's death, their friendship transforms into a relationship defined by mutual guilt and suspicion. Shelley correctly perceives that Mira's offer to make her executive director isn't generosity, but self-preservation, ensuring Shelley would take the blame if their crime is discovered. This exploration of complicity extends beyond individual psychology to examine how systems perpetuate wrongdoing by distributing responsibility. Lemoyne's rare earth mining operation involves layers of complicity, from the mercenaries who believe they're working for the CIA to the Darvishes who suspect something is amiss but accept Lemoyne's money anyway. By diffusing responsibility across multiple actors, systems of exploitation make it difficult for any individual to feel fully accountable. Throughout Burnham Wood, characters struggle to impose order on an increasingly chaotic reality, revealing the fundamental human desire for control and the illusion that we can master our circumstances. Lemoyne embodies this illusion most completely. His surveillance systems, technological manipulation, and meticulous planning create an impression of godlike control. He monitors everyone through hacked phones and drones, intercepts and alters communications, and orchestrates elaborate cover stories. When complications arise, like Tony discovering his mining operation or Darvish's unexpected death, he quickly formulates plans to contain the damage. He prefers situations that are single, swift, and clean rather than messy and multiple, reflecting his algorithmic approach to reality. Yet despite his technological power and wealth, Lemoyne cannot control everything. He misses Owen Darvish's email about coming to Thorndyke, he fails to capture Tony after he escapes into the forest. Most significantly, he doesn't anticipate Lady Darvish's suspicions or her decisive action in the novel's climax. The limitations of his control reveal the hubris in believing technology can insulate us from uncertainty or eliminate risk. Mira similarly seeks control through planning and rationalization. She carefully organizes Burnham Wood's operations, justifies her moral compromises through elaborate reasoning, and attempts to manage others' perceptions of her actions. When events spiral beyond her control, Shelley's accidental killing of Darvish, Tony's appearance with evidence of Lemoyne's environmental crimes, she desperately grasps for new narratives that might restore her sense of agency. The novel suggests that our desire for control often makes us more vulnerable, not less. By believing we can manage all variables and predict all outcomes, we blind ourselves to the inherent unpredictability of complex systems, whether ecological, technological, or human. This illusion of control becomes particularly dangerous when combined with power, as with Lemoyne, whose confidence in his ability to manipulate situations leads him to take increasingly reckless risks. The Shakespearean reference in the title underscores this theme. In Macbeth, the protagonist believes himself invincible based on the prophecy that none of woman born can harm him and that he will not be defeated until Birnam Wood comes to Dunsinane Hill. These seemingly impossible conditions give him a false sense of security until they are fulfilled in unexpected ways. Similarly, the characters in Catton's novel believe themselves protected by various forms of insurance, wealth, technology, moral righteousness, only to discover these protections are illusory. The novel's climactic confrontation brings together all its thematic threads in a devastating finale that questions whether justice is possible in a world of such profound power imbalances. After discovering Tony hiding in the forest with evidence of Lemoyne's environmental crimes, Mira experiences a surge of hope that she might not be the true villain after all. This revelation offers her a potential moral redemption. Perhaps her complicity in covering up Darvish's death could be balanced against exposing Lemoyne's greater crimes. Yet this hope proves short-lived when Lemoyne captures them both. Lady Darvish's unexpected arrival at the farm represents another form of justice. Having pieced together the truth about her husband's death and Lemoyne's deception, she confronts him with a rifle. In a moment of transcendent calm, remembering how Owen had taught her to shoot, breathe out before you shoot, at the bottom of the breath, you're steadier than at the top, she kills Lemoyne with a shot between the eyes. This act of vigilante justice briefly suggests that individual moral courage might prevail against systemic corruption. Yet Lady Darvish is immediately shot by Lemoyne's driver, revealing the limits of individual action against organized power. The novel refuses easy catharsis or the comfort of conventional justice. Tony's final act, setting fire to the leaching pits in Korowai National Park, represents yet another ambiguous form of justice. As he drags his broken body through the bush, pulls a net into a leaching pit, and sets it aflame, he hopes someone will see the smoke, notice the destruction, and come to put it out. This desperate act aims to expose Lemoyne's environmental crimes, yet it also causes further ecological damage. The fire spreading up ancient trees suggests that even well-intentioned resistance can have destructive consequences. The novel's ending refuses resolution or redemption. We don't learn whether Tony's fire successfully exposes Lemoyne's operation, whether any characters survive to tell the truth, or whether justice in any form is achieved. This ambiguity reflects the novel's complex moral vision. In a world where power, technology, and wealth are so unevenly distributed, conventional notions of justice may be inadequate or impossible. Instead, the novel suggests that catastrophe might be the only force capable of disrupting entrenched systems of exploitation. The fire in Korowai National Park, like the landslide that initially closed the mountain pass, represents nature's capacity to overwhelm human attempts at control. These catastrophes reveal the hubris in believing we can extract indefinitely without consequence. Birnam Wood offers a profound meditation on the collision between idealism and pragmatism in an age of surveillance capitalism and environmental crisis. Through its complex characters and morally ambiguous situations, it explores how principles are tested when confronted with opportunity, power, and fear. The novel refuses easy answers or moral certainties. It acknowledges the genuine appeal of Lemoyne's offer to Birnam Wood, the possibility of expanding their impact and creating sustainable food systems with proper funding. It recognizes the limitations of Tony's uncompromising ideological purity, which might preserve moral integrity at the cost of practical effectiveness. It shows how Mira's pragmatic compromises, while potentially expanding the collective's reach, lead to a slippery slope of moral concessions that ultimately corrupt her purpose. By setting these ethical dilemmas against the backdrop of environmental exploitation, the novel connects personal moral choices to larger systemic issues. It suggests that our individual compromises, justifications, and self-deceptions mirror and enable the broader exploitation of nature. Just as Lemoyne rationalizes his environmental destruction through cost-benefit analyses, Mira justifies her moral compromises through utilitarian reasoning. The Shakespearean allusion in the title points to the novel's ultimate message. In Macbeth, Birnam Wood doesn't literally march to Dunsinane. Soldiers disguise themselves with branches, creating the illusion of a moving forest. This image suggests that nature doesn't fight back directly against human exploitation. Rather, humans eventually turn against each other, using nature as their cover and justification. Yet the novel also hints at nature's capacity to overwhelm human systems through catastrophe, landslides, fires, floods. These disasters reveal the limits of our control and the consequences of our exploitation. They suggest that while we might temporarily profit from extracting resources and manipulating systems, we cannot escape the interconnected web of ecological and social relationships that ultimately determines our fate. In our current era of climate crisis and digital surveillance, Birnam Wood offers a timely warning about the personal and collective costs of moral compromise. It challenges us to examine our own complicity in systems of exploitation and to consider whether our pragmatic accommodations with power ultimately undermine the values we claim to uphold. Most importantly, it reminds us that no amount of technological control or wealth can insulate us from the consequences of our actions, that sooner or later, metaphorically speaking, the forest will come to Dunsinane.